Frequency range affects about 50 million garage door users around the United States. And also there were some issues in other states at different times as well that have had similar incidents. The government's going to try to see if they can slightly adjust the frequency to still meet their needs and not interfere, but if they can't, all of the homeowners will have to spend about $250 to have new units installed. Let's see, some of the other states that were affected at different times were Florida, Maryland, and Pennsylvania as well. So that was just kind of an interesting little, found it somewhat humorous, but certainly probably a little annoying for those who had to deal with it. Let's swing on over to EFF.org, that's Electronic Frontier Foundation. They're a nonprofit group of lawyers and others who are out there fighting for defending your freedom in the digital world, fighting for digital rights. Excuse me. So they, I've been donating them for a number of years, and they've helped fight a number of cases. They win some, lose some. They've fought in peer-to-peer battles, and AT&T and monitoring, and the Recording Industry Association, and many others. And plus, they fund projects like the Tor Network, which helps anonymize your connection by rerouting your traffic through other servers so that they can't really tell where it's coming from, as open source. And they're right now talking about they're dealing with the Florida officials and the vendors there resisting independent analysis of the voting machines there. And there's a Tuesday hearing on December 19th in Tallahassee, Florida. They're going to consider whether representatives of Florida voters will gain access to voting machines and software in a contested election of the U.S. House Representative seat for Florida's 13th Congressional District. And this whole... So that's the little news headline, then I'll do my little editorial opine from my background as a retired computer scientist and a specialist in information security in the past, and certified through the SANS Institute, which is an organization that was originally founded by the NSA and the FBI. So the big ongoing issue with these voting machines is that they don't leave a good audit trail, especially the ones that do not provide a paper backup. So it makes it easy if someone can get access to the machine. All they need is a few seconds to change the data in the system since it's all digital. And if they do it right, they can do it without leaving a trace, whereas it's a little more involved if there's a paper backup or other methods. And so this is the ongoing battle between the vendors and the government agencies trying to keep costs to a minimum for the product and make things easier for them to do rather than more complex as far as providing functionality. But unfortunately, they need to learn, as with any security, that if you don't leave an audit trail, you're always leaving yourself wide open. And they need to enable a means of keeping an audit path of any changes that are made, and in a way that can't be easily removed. Paper is one way. It's not the only way, but it's the one people keep talking about. It. There are other options, but they involved networking and private networks and encryption and offsite locations for backup, etc., and there's pros and cons to that as well. But they definitely need to add a better method of auditing to end this ongoing debate. And we'll see what happens if they finally figure it out with enough protest going on there. Some other headlines going on. Let's see. EFF accepts Barney's surrender. The corporate owners of the popular children's television character Barney the Purple Dinosaur have agreed to withdraw their baseless legal threats against a website publisher who parodied the character and to compensate him for fees expended in defending himself. Oh, boy. And the EFF is also fighting to try to shield email from secret government searches. The government must have a search warrant before it can search and seize email stored by email service providers, according to a friend of the court brief filed last week by EFF. and a coalition of civil liberty groups. They're still fighting for that. And so there's a lot more there. I just give you a few highlights, and if you want to check out the rest of it, EFF.org has a lot of information on that. Over on /dot.org, their motto is News for Nerd Stuff That Matters. They are talking about ePassport and how it was cloned in 5 minutes. Last month, a panel of European Union experts warned that the ePassport security is poorly conceived. And a little aside on that's been known for years. And in fact, a week later, a British newspaper demonstrated a crack. Now another researcher has shown how to clone a European ePassport in under 5 minutes. A UK Home Office spokesman dismissed it all, saying, "It is hard to see why anyone would want to access the information on the chip." Oh my. So keep that in mind. Any of those passport integrated products, you know, there's some serious flaws and risks there. See what else we have here. Sorry, some of the headlines were humorous, but I'm not going to read that. Adult brains grow from specialist use. I'm not going to continue. That doesn't really have anything to do with the topic, but it was humorous. Okay. Vista versus Cairo, a Microsoft history lesson. There's a nice history lesson online there by the unfortunately infamous Daniel Aaron, arguing why the Longhorn Vista Road is very similar to the NT Cairo Road that Microsoft took in the 90s, effectively trying their best to discourage competition in the marketplace. So what they're talking about there is so Longhorn Vista, the new version of Microsoft Windows coming out, he's arguing that they're taking Microsoft's taking the same approach they did in the 90s with Windows NT, codenamed Cairo, in the 90s, where they had a whole slew of unfair marketing pressures put on vendors and such to carry only their products and to exclude any other choices. And Microsoft was found guilty of those things through the courts, but they just got slaps on the wrist as far as financial issues. And they constantly are dealing with monopoly violation lawsuits and investigations. But every time they get actually charged, the fines are such a pittance. You know, $20 million here and $20 million there, it, to them, doesn't really add up to that much, especially after all those years. Although they do certainly have to invest in the legal fees. And so this Daniel Aaron is arguing that they're repeating the same process again with Vista, and making it so that people don't really have choices in their operating system and software included with their hardware, making it very difficult for vendors to sell and compete if they offer multiple choices. So, for example, when I was a CIO for a small PC retail custom building computer store, And unfortunately, a lot of the providers do this across the board. Intel would give us a better break if we would not carry AMD than if, you know, if we carried AMD, then we'd have to pay Intel more. We wouldn't get to be as close a partner because we weren't Intel exclusive. The same thing with Windows is Windows would sell us Windows licenses a lot cheaper if we only offered Windows operating systems and no others. And we decided not to do that, take the hit on the cost to give our customers better choices and as far as we were concerned, better quality options. But it also meant fewer support issues on our end, too, by giving those people those choices. But what happened was it was a significant difference. So, for example, they have different tiers of partnerships. And if we were a close partner, we might only have to spend, let's say, $50 or $100 per Windows license per computer, and then we could get a little bit of markup on that or cut as close as we want. But if we weren't as close a partner, then it might be $100, $200 for that. And meanwhile, the Joe PC shop down the street, or one of the big ones, would be a close partner, and they'd be able to keep their PC price, their computer prices, lower because they're not having to spend as much on the software license. So you can see how that, so if people are just shopping around for price, they'd end up looking, well, he's $50 cheaper. I'm going over there even for the exact same product, in theory. And so they're able to put pressure on businesses by doing that. And so here we go again. It's happening yet again with the next version of Windows coming out. Surprise, surprise. Let's see what else we have here. Something else I wanted to mention. I forgot to bring this up. I can't remember if I mentioned in a previous show that actually Novell, who bought out SUSE Linux, which is a German version of Linux, and in my opinion, one of the friendlier versions of Linux for non-technical users. So my wife and kids use it, and other people who aren't especially technical use SUSE Linux because they find it fairly easy to install, set up, and use, and it's not a huge change for them whether they're coming from Mac or Windows. So a few years ago, SUSE Linux was its own German company of open source software developers up in Germany. Novell bought them out. Now, this is not the first time Novell had bought a Linux company. In previous years, it had been Caldera Linux. And unfortunately, that was a disaster, and there's still repercussions from that. They bought Caldera Linux. It was a pretty good version of Linux back in the 90s, late 90s. And then they messed it up from a technical perspective. It just became a lot buggier and unusable, and I stopped using it and testing it out and became very frustrated with it. But what was worse is in later years, as they divested themselves of Caldera, but Caldera continued on as an entity, the Caldera division started suing Linux users claiming that there was proprietary Unix source code, not Linux, but actual Unix source code in some Linux distributions, and that the users owed them licensing fees. Some of them were hundreds of dollars per seat. Per seat means per user. And this got pretty ugly around the early 2000s, 2001, 2003 time period. And it involved even lawsuits against IBM and others. And it turned out that Microsoft had invested a pretty healthy chunk of money into Caldera just as just before these lawsuits started happening. And so you make of that what you will. Anyhow, what this did is, even though the lawsuits weren't really viable per se, as they're shown over and over and over in court briefing after court briefing, they stonewalled and got a lot of press. And so what was happening was there was a huge transition happening very quickly, switched over to Linux from Windows. And what this did is, in effect, slowed down that transition, because a lot of CIOs and CTOs, chief information and chief technology officers, and CEOs as well, chief executive officers, became nervous about the patent infringements that were being claimed and didn't want to end up getting stuck with unexpected costs. So they were afraid to make the switch over to Linux, and it literally stopped millions of seats transitioning over to Linux. So it was a pretty effective tactic by Caldera, a.k.a. those who invested in them for the back door, to slow down the transition. And still to this day, the black mark from that, I've run into people who they have a fear of buying large amounts of Linux seats, for fear that they're going to get sued for some sort of patent infringement somewhere. So it was very, very effective. And of course, again, it's been proven to be pretty bogus as far as any actual viability to force people to pay that and to license that, etc. But unfortunately, the damage has been done from a marketing perspective. It definitely slowed things down, at least for a few years. It's starting to pick back up again as people's memories, short-term memories, fade. And now you're seeing a large number of people transitioning to other alternatives besides Microsoft Windows, such as Linux and BSD and Mac OS X, etc. And in fact, especially outside of the United States, there's a huge switch. Unfortunately, a lot of it's fueled by the anti-Americanism going on from various responses to activities that we take around the world in other countries. So other countries in Europe and Asia and such are finding alternatives to using American products, and one of those venues is open source products. A lot of people. In recent years, Munich, Germany converted 14,000 systems from Windows to Linux. That's just one of many instances, but there's also a lot of transition going on here in the States. So, coming around full circle here to my point, recently, this summer and fall, Novell and Microsoft announced a mutual agreement that they would build interoperability between Windows and Linux so that they'd be able to play well together, play better together than they do as far as file sharing and office formats between OpenOffice and Microsoft Office, etc. So there'd be a little bit smoother transition. Now, on the face of it, that sounds great. I heard from my son that one parent here in Spokane thought that that meant that Microsoft had bought Linux, and I will assure you that that did not happen, nor could it happen, since Linux is not owned by any one company. Now, the name could, if Linus Torvalds, the creator of the GNU Linux name, ever decided to sell the name, he could sell the name, but he couldn't sell off all of what is Linux, since it's under a license that doesn't allow that. It has to remain open source. And since the Linux community is millions of developers strong, and none of them under any one entity, organization, whether business or non-business, it's basically impossible to buy out Linux. You can buy certain distros, like Novell bought SUSE Linux, but you cannot buy Linux itself. Just to put that to rest, since I was hearing some interesting rumor mongering going on to that effect. However, it is true that hell did freeze over, and Microsoft and Novell, aka SUSE Linux, are working together. This explains some phone calls I actually received a previous year ago from Redmond, asking for some of my services related to Linux integration with Windows, so it kind of fits into place some interesting puzzles that I had come across last year. The question is, though, is this a real effort to integrate, or is it really an effort to subvert, as in Microsoft's partnership with Sun's Java programming language? Back in the 90s, when Java was first coming out, Java is a programming language. Some of you might have heard of programming languages such as BASIC, or C, or C++, or Pascal. There are many others, but those are some of the more well-known ones: Visual Basic, .NET, C#, etc. There are many, many, many programming languages out there. And what a programming language does is it's a way for a human being to write code that is then translated into machine language, and it's a way to interface between human concepts and making the computer do what you want them to do without having to plug the computer straight into your brain, which we haven't quite figured that out yet. So, Java is a programming language that Sun came out with. Some of it was based on Smalltalk. It uses a lot of the C++ syntax, which means a lot of the way they write the sentences, in effect, looks similar between C++ and Java. Some big differences between Java, some key differences were, one, if you wrote a Java program, in theory you could run it on any computer that supported Java. So it didn't matter if it was a Windows computer, a Mac computer, a Linux computer, a wristwatch computer, a television computer, a refrigerator computer. If it was able to support Java, your program that you wrote, in theory, would run on it. And so they called it Write Once, Run Anywhere. And for the most part, that's been fairly effective. It has not been without its flaws and issues. But compared to most programming languages, like C and C++, where you literally have to rewrite it for each one, rewrite major chunks of the code just to make it work on each platform, so for the most part people don't bother, it was very effective. I was so glad. I was so sick of having to write programs for Windows and then rewrite the same program for Mac, and then rewrite the same program for Linux, and then rewrite the same program for Amiga, if people remember Amiga at all. and then rewrite it, the same program to have a web interface instead of a desktop interface. Same program, but I had to rewrite a lot of it just so that it worked differently. With Java, I could write it, and then most of the time I didn't have to write anything else or very few lines of code to change the interface between web and local. And it was wonderful. It had a lot of bugs. 1.0 came out, and it was struggling, etc. But it was on the right track. One complaint people have is Java tends to be slower because of how it works as a virtual machine. In order for it to run on different platforms, it has to go through some different ways of talking computer languages, and that it's some extra steps, and that slows it down. But over the years, it's become more and more efficient. So anyway, Microsoft entered into a contract agreement with Sun to have a licensed version of Java. Java's not open source. Sun's created a community license thing, but it's not the best license. But it's kind of a halfway open source, if and until Sun changed their mind or something. That's the only gotcha about it. But so far, Sun's been pretty good about behaving with that, for the most part. So anyway, Microsoft signed a license to make a Microsoft version of Java, the Java Virtual Machine, and they came out with Visual Java. And it was a piece of garbage. And unfortunately, what it did is it gave Java a big black eye. Well, it turned out, after Sun took them to court, after years of proceedings and another $20 million fine, that Microsoft had intentionally sabotaged the Java virtual machine to make Java appear to run like garbage on Windows, so that people would be more interested in writing Microsoft-based programming languages, Visual Basic and Visual C++ and later on .NET, rather than writing in Java languages, because they were seeing a huge influx of people switching over from Microsoft Visual C++ and Visual Basic over to Java. Because again, the multi-platform support and also many other benefits I won't get into because it's pretty technical, automatic garbage collection, etc. And so by making it look like Java ran terribly, if you had Microsoft JVM installed, Java Virtual Machine, it made a lot of people go, I don't want to write Java, it runs like garbage, why would I do that? I'll just write Microsoft products since they dominate. And so unfortunately it was proven in court that Microsoft intentionally sabotaged that, and they had to pay a slap on the wrist of a $20 million fine and agree not to do it again, etc., etc. But yet again, a lot of the damage was done. And you couldn't really avoid it because it was when you did Windows Update, you would get the Java virtual machine from Microsoft through the update that was corrupt. It just wreaked havoc. So unfortunately, you can see how these partnerships they seem good intentions up front, but you really have to watch out. And I don't mean to single out only Microsoft. It's just that since that's relevant to this specific topic, I'm giving an example of how Microsoft sabotaged a partnership in the past with Java compared to what they might do now with Linux and their partnership with Novell. We'll just have to wait and see what happens, and I'll cross my fingers and hope that they have turned over a new leaf and made some changes. We'll see what happens. So that was some interesting news there. And it looks like, let's see if there's any other topics here I might cover for tonight. Still waiting to hear back from the KYRS program committee to start a separate show instead of just doing my Tech Talk segment as part of the Synthetic Zen show. I'm going to be doing a one-hour show of Tech Talk with Hawk at a specific time. It hasn't been solidified yet, so I'm still waiting for the final word from the programming committee for that. So I'll just keep doing it as a segment of this show. And as a reminder, you can download archives of all my shows at my website at www.synthzen.com. That's SYNTHZEN.com. That's the new version of my site. I still have the old version of the site with some of the older archives. I haven't moved them all over yet at www.thesyntheticzenshow.com. It's a bit more typing and a mouthful, but you can see the old site that way and grab the old archives there if you like. But the new site will be much, much better once I'm finished transitioning over. And I'm happy to take questions for the Tech Talk shows. You can always call the studio at 509-747-3807. You can also instant message me and IRC me at it's Internet Relay Chat if you'd like. There's the contact information on my website for all of that to send those messages. And of course, you can email me and you can just send it to z@synthzen.com. and post any questions or topics you'd like to hear on the show discussed. Anything that has to do with technology and how it affects your privacy, civil rights, and security, feel free to post a question, and I'll make sure to get responses out on the air for you. Hope you've enjoyed this segment of Tech Talk with Hawk. Going to go ahead and get back to the normal synthetic Zen show mixture here of ambient